Jacob was silent, and Esau went on between his sobs, and saying that which his soul had need to hear. And ah, how wrathful was the old man when I came after thee, and brought what I had prepared, that he might be strengthened for the blessing, and he understood that it was not Esau who had come before. He was wroth beyond all measure, and cried out again and again, Who then was the huntsman? Who was he? For now he has the blessing, for I had strengthened myself to give it. Esau, my Esau, what remaineth us to do? Jacob was silent. Be not so silent, smooth man, cried Esau. Thou sittest in thy self-seeking silence, and givest it out still silent for mild forbearance, until it maketh my gall to rise. Have I not right that the old man loved me, and was angry beyond all measure? Thou sayest it, answered Jacob, and Esau had to be content. But that he said it did not make it more true than it was, did not make it less involved. It still remained half-truth and equivocal, and that Jacob first kept silent and then answered in monosyllables was not due to dissembling or spite, but to his feelings of helplessness before the complicated nature of the whole affair, which could not be got at in Esau's way with wailings and exclaimings, natural as they were and fitting to Esau's character, the self-deceiving and extenuating emotions of the survivor, who tries to put in the best light the relations that existed between him and the deceased. It might be true that Isaac had been angry when Esau appeared, after Jacob had been there, for the old man might have feared that some stranger had been with him in the darkness, some villain who was no relation at all, and made off with the blessing, which would certainly have been regarded as a catastrophe. But whether he would have been so enraged, and so sincerely enraged, if he had known that it was Jacob who preceded Esau, was a question not so easily answered as Esau's heart was fain to answer it. It was at bottom the same question as the other one, whether the love of the parents had actually been divided between the sons on the simple lines laid down by Esau, with red-skinned on the one side and little Yekov on the other. Jacob found some ground for doubt on the subject, but felt it unfitting to bring the same to the notice of his weeping brother. Often, when the younger lad nestled at his mother's side, she had told him how hard it had been to carry the brothers in the months before they were born, how she had dragged herself about, misshapen and clumsy on her overburdened feet, while in her womb the two would not have peace, but strove together over precedence. She said that he, Jacob, was actually the firstborn in the eyes of Isaac's God, but that Esau had claimed the right with such violence that Jacob had courteously retired before him, very likely in the secret conviction that not much attention is paid between twins to the small difference in age, that it was not actually decisive, and that only outside and in the course of time would the true firstborn be made manifest, the smoke of whose sacrifice would rise to the nostrils of the Most High. Rebecca's account seemed probable. Yes, Jacob certainly might have behaved like that. He himself seemed to recall doing it. But what the mother's tale betrayed was precisely this, that Esau's defiant little bid for priority had never been taken seriously by the parents, and the expectation of the blessing had for long hung in the balance between the brothers, even up to their early manhood and the fatal day, so that Esau might complain of a decision made against him, but not of an arbitrary injustice. For a long time, especially in the eyes of the father, his actual priority had weighed heavily enough to overcome any disinclination to Esau's character, and by character I mean his physical as well as his mental and moral parts. But the time came when it did so no more. Red-haired he had been from the beginning, all over his body, like the fell of a bezoar, and equipped with a full set of teeth. These were uncanny manifestations, but Isaac set himself to welcome and interpret them in the most favorable sense. He wanted to stick to the elder-born, and was himself the author and for long years the champion of the idea to which Esau clung, that Esau was his son, and Jacob the mother's. He spoke to the fair-skinned and toothless infant, and admonished his own soul, for about the small person was a sort of mild radiance. He had a wise and friendly little smile, whereas the other wrinkled up his face and squalled intolerably. But the smooth one was obviously delicate. There was not much hope of him, while the hairy one seemed made of heroic stuff and would certainly go far. Such like phrases the father used every day, quoting old saws mechanically, though his voice sometimes trembled with inward irritation, for Esau wounded Rebekah's breast with his untimely little teeth, so that they became inflamed, and young Jacob had to be fed on diluted goat's milk. "He will be a hero," was what Isaac said to that, "and he is my son and my firstborn. But the smooth one is thine, daughter of Bethuel, heart of my heart." For he called her so in this connection, and said that the gentle child was her son, and the rough one his. Which, then, did he prefer? Esau. So it was stated later in the shepherd's songs, and was known at the time in all the region round about. Yitzhak loves Esau. Rebekah, Jacob. Such was the view fostered by Yitzhak, and supported by his own words. A little myth within a much larger and more significant one, but contradicting the larger one to such extent that it finally brought about Yitzhak's blindness. We are to understand this statement in the light of the fact that the fusion of soul and body is far more profound, the soul something much more physical, and the body much more malleable by the soul than has at times been thought. Isaac was blind, or as good as blind, when he died. There is no denying it. But when his twins were small, his eyesight was not nearly so poor, and if by the time they were young men it had grown very much worse, that was due to the fact that he had neglected it for years, had humored it by disuse, and excused it on the ground of his tendency to conjunctivitis, an ailment very prevalent in his circle, Leah and several of her sons suffering from it all their lives. But the real ground was distaste. Is it possible for a man to become blind, or as nearly blind as Yitzhak was in his old age, because he does not like to see, because seeing is a torture to him, because he feels better in a darkness where certain things can happen which must happen? I do not assert that such a cause would have such a result, but only that the causes were present. Esau was precocious, like an animal. When still a mere boy, he married several times, daughters of Canaan, Hittite women, Hivites, as we know. First Judith and Ada, then Aholibamah and Bashemoth. He lodged his wives in his father's tents, was fruitful with them, and allowed them and their brood to practice their ancestral nature and idol worship under the eye of his parents. The more unconcernedly that he himself lacked all feeling for his father's lofty inheritance, had struck up a hunting friendship with the people of Seir in the south, and openly paid homage to the tempestuous Cusach. And as the song later had it, and it still stands in the chronicle, this was a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. To both of them, but of course far more to Yitzhak than to his sister bride, although Rebekah gave vent to her irritation, and Isaac was silent. He was silent, and when he spoke, his words were, "Mine is the red one. The firstborn is he, and I hold him dear." But Isaac, the bearer of the blessing, and custodian of the God idea which Abram had won, whom his brothers in the faith regarded as the son and reincarnation of the Chaldean, Isaac suffered sore by reason of what he saw, or must close his eyes to in order not to see it, and suffered from his own weakness, which prevented him from making an end of the difficulty by sending Esau into the wilderness, as had actually been done with Ishmael, his beautiful wild uncle. The little inner myth prevented him, Esau's actual priority of birth, which still bore heavily on the vexed question as to which of the twins was the chosen one. Thus he complained of his eyes, how they ran, and of the burning of the lids, and that he saw dimly like the dying moon, that the light hurt him, and he sought the darkness. Shall we say that he became blind in order not to witness the idol worship of his daughters-in-law? Ah, that was the least among all that offended his sight that made him long for blindness, because only so could that happen which must happen. For the older the boys grew, the clearer to a seeing eye grew the lines of the great myth, which, despite all the father's principles, made the little myth more and more forced and untenable. The clearer it became who they both were, in whose footsteps they walked, on whose story they were founded, the red man and the smooth man, the huntsman and the dweller in tents. How could Isaac, who with Ishmael the wild ass had formed the brother pair, who himself had not been Cain but Abel, not Ham but Shem, not Set but Osiris, not Ishmael but Isaac the true-born son, how could he, with seeing eyes, have supported the claim that he preferred Esau? So his eyes failed him like the dying moon, and he lay in darkness that he might be betrayed, together with Esau, his eldest son. The Great Hoaxing. But actually nobody was deceived, not even Esau. For if I am venturing here to write about people who did not always know precisely who they were, Esau himself not being of the clearest on the subject, and sometimes taking himself for the original goat of the Seir people, and mentioning him in the first person, yet this occasional lack of clarity had to do only with the individual and the time conditioned, and was precisely the consequence of the fact that everybody knew perfectly well outside of time, and mythically and typically speaking, who the individual was. And so did Esau, of whom it has not been idly said that he was in his way as pious a man as Jacob. He wept and raved, of course, after the betrayal, and was more murderously minded against his favored brother than Ishmael had been against his. Indeed, it is true that he discussed with Ishmael an attack upon Isaac as well as upon Jacob, but he did all that because it was the role he had to play. He knew and accepted the fact that all events are a fulfillment, and that what had happened because it must, according to the archetype. That is to say, it was not the first time. It was ceremonially and in conformity to pattern. It had acquired presentness as in a recurrent feast, and come round as feasts do. For Esau, Joseph's uncle, was not the father of Edom. Therefore, when the hour came, the brothers being almost 30, when Yitzhak, out of the darkness of his tent, sent the slave who served him, a youth lacking one ear, it having been cut off on account of his light-headedness and manifold shortcomings, greatly to his amendment, to stand before Esau where he worked with the hands in the ploughed field, to fold his arms across his black chest and announce, "The master hath need of my lord." Esau stood like one rooted to the ground, and his ruddy face paled under the sweat that covered it. He murmured the formula of compliance, "Here am I." But in his soul he thought, "Now is the time." And that soul was full of pride and dread and solemn unrest of mind. Then he left the sunny field and went in to his father, who lay in the half-light with two little damp pledgets on his eyes, made an obeisance and said, "My lord hath summoned me." Isaac answered rather querulously, "That is the voice of my son Esau. Is it thou, Esau? I've called thee, for the hour is at hand. Come near to me, my eldest son, that I may be sure of thee." And Esau knelt in his goatskin apron beside the couch, and raised up his eyes to the little pledgets, as though he would bore through them into his father's eyes, while Isaac felt his shoulders and arms and breast, saying, "Yea, these are thy fells, and Esau's red fleece. I see them with my hands, which for good or evil have learned right well to fill the place of my declining eyes. Hearken now, my son, and open thine ears, and receive the words of thy sightless father, for the hour is come. Behold, now I am old. I know not the day of my death, and as my eyes have long since failed, So it may be that I shall soon fail utterly and disappear into the darkness, so that my life is night and no more seen. Therefore, that I die not before I hand on the blessing and give the power from me and the inheritance, let it be now as it hath been. Go hence, my son, and take thy weapons, thy quiver and bow, with which thou art mighty before the Lord, and go about in the plain and the field, and take me venison, and make me savory meat such as I love, cooked in sour milk by a bright fire, and well seasoned, and bring it to me that I may eat and be strengthened, that I may bless thee before I die with seeing hands. This is my will. Now go.
It is already done, murmured Esau perfunctorily. Yet remained upon his knees, and only bowed his head low so that the blind eyes stared over it into space.
Art thou still there? Asked Isaac. A moment I thought thou wast already gone, and was not surprised, for the father is accustomed to have all performed quickly, in love and fear, according to his wish.
It is already done, repeated Esau, and went out. But after he had lifted the skin at the door of the tent, he let it fall and came back, knelt again by the couch, and spoke with breaking voice.
My father!
What then?
Asked Isaac, raising his brows above the pledgets.
It is well, he said then. Go, my son, for the hour is come that is great for thee and for us all. Go, hunt and cook, that I may bless thee.
And Esau went out with his head high, and stood before the tent in the hour of his pride, and in a loud voice announced to all within hearing his impending honor. For events do not happen all at once. They happen point for point. They develop according to pattern, and it would be false to call a narrative entirely sad because the end is so. A tale with a lamentable close has yet its stages and times of honor, and it is right to regard these not from the point of view of the end, but rather in their own light, for while they are the present, they have equal strength with the presentness of the conclusion. Thus Esau was proud in his hour, and cried out with a ringing voice, Hear ye, people of the court, children of Abram, and who burn sacrifice to Yah. Hear ye, too, ye who sacrifice to Baal, wives of Esau, and your seed, the fruit of my loins. Esau's hour is come. The Lord will bless his son today. Isaac sendeth me forth to the fields, that with the bow I may find him savory meat to strengthen him for my sake. Fall down! And while those at hand who heard him fell upon their faces, Esau saw a maid running so that her breasts danced up and down. That was the maid who short-windedly announced to Rebekah what Esau had said in his boasting. And again the maid, quite breathless from running, came to Jacob, who was tending the sheep in company with a crop-eared dog named Tam, and leaning, sunk in thought, on a long staff with a crook at the top. She gasped with her forehead bent to the grass, The mistress! Jacob looked at her, and after a pause of some length answered very low, Here am I. For in the pause he had thought in his soul, The hour is come. And his heart was full of pride and awe. He gave his staff to Tam to watch and went in to Rebekah, who was awaiting him impatiently. Rebekah, the successor of Sarah, was a matron with gold earrings, stately and strong-boned, with large features that still possessed much of the beauty once so alluring to Abimelech of Gerar. The gaze of her black eyes was shrewd and steadfast beneath arched brows that were evenly accentuated with penciling, and showed between them the two perpendicular folds of an energetic character. Her nose was well-formed and masculine, with a pronounced hook and distended nostrils. Her voice was deep and resonant, and there was a line of little black hairs on her upper lip. Her black and silver locks were parted in the middle and came down upon her forehead, veiled by the brown headcloth which hung far down her back but left uncovered the fine shape of her noble shoulders and arms. These were in color an amber brown, and the years had had as yet no power to touch them. She wore an ungirdled garment of figured wool, reaching down to her ankles. Her small veined hands had just now been busy at the loom set up in the middle of the floor, correcting the women who squatted there, using their fingers and wooden pegs to urge the flaxen woof through the warp. But she had stopped their work and sent them away, and was waiting for her son inside her own tent, the mistress's tent, hung with skins and mats. She moved swiftly towards Jacob as he respectfully entered.
"Yekuf, my son," said she, softly and low,
and drew his upraised hands to her breast.
"The time has come. The master would bless thee.